For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, it's Murder in Bradford, as thriller writer Liz Mistry introduces us to her new detective.
She's working class, she's of dual heritage, she's a single parent with three children, and she's got a secret past that she hasn't really told anyone about.
Narrator Caroline Lennon discusses her love of Irish literature and her role in The Archers.
First of all, they sent me to Germany, the ultimate punishment. When that wasn't enough, I died for good.
And author N.B. Dixon tells us what she thought of A Thousand Ships. That's all coming up in today's show. Liz Mistry is an accomplished crime writer. Her latest book, Last Request, is the first in a new series featuring D.S. Nikita Parekh, a fierce and uncompromising detective in Bradford CID, battling violence, drug gangs, and a serial killer. Liz Mistry joined me down the line. Liz Mistry, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So, for those who haven't yet read Last Request, can you set the scene for us?
Well, Last Request is the first in a new series of books set in Bradford with D.S. Nikita Parekh as the main detective. Basically, Nikki, she's got a bit of a chip on her shoulder. She's not your typical detective. She's working class, she's of dual heritage, she's a single parent with three children, and she's got a secret past that she hasn't really told anyone about. And in Last Request, that secret past comes to light. Basically, it's a serial killer novel set in Bradford, and it's what I would call gritty noir. It's not for the faint-hearted.
It really is. I mean, Nikki is bold and brave and battle-scarred and pretty bullshy, isn't she?
She certainly is, and I wanted her to be like that. You don't get many strong female protagonists, well, generally in literature, but in crime fiction. I really wanted to address that. But as well as that, you don't get very many detectives who aren't white or who aren't able-bodied or who aren't male. It's very difficult to find a book that has people who are from marginalised communities. And that's something that I like to address in my books, because obviously living in Bradford, it's a very diverse community. And I'm not talking about just diverse ethnicities. I'm talking about diversity in terms of sexuality, gender, age, class, everything. To write a really good crime novel, you need to be able to dip into all sections of society. And I think part of what crime fiction does is it does give voice to the disenfranchised, if you like. And that's where Nikki came from, I think.
Yeah, she really reflects the society that she lives in. And you don't dress it up. Bradford, like many British cities, has its problems with drugs and violence and gangs. And she's pitched right into the centre of that.
Yeah, because I didn't want to name any particular areas in Bradford or any particular estates in Bradford, because I'm always mindful that people live there. It's their homes, and I don't want to capitalise on making other people feel bad. So I created a new estate. And yeah, I had Nikki in the heart of it. So she's in the heart of this Asian community, but it sort of breaks into the working class white community. And the communities are very similar in terms of the disadvantage that they have in society. And I wanted to look at that through Nikki's eyes, through someone that's living it herself and is concerned about her family being in that environment, but is still pulled to it by a loyalty about community and things like that.
Well, there's a sense in which she, being mixed race, bridges two communities, but is also suspected by both communities of not being fully on their side. And there's another very unpleasant young character who, though he's also dual heritage, wants to identify as white and deny the Asian part of himself.
Yeah, that's Dino, I think you're talking about. Yeah. He's awful, isn't he?
He's a rat bag.
Yeah, Dino is one of the scum, if you like, that Nikki wants to protect her family from. Clearly, he's from a dysfunctional family. He's not had it easy, but he's got involved in drugs and he's got involved in gangs. And he really doesn't care. He blames his mum, I think, for everything that's happened to him. And like you say, he's of dual heritage himself, but he's got Nazi tattoos and he quite happily will use racist terms to talk about Nikki and things like that. So it's quite a confused sort of environment to be in for some of them, I think.
You raise some very interesting questions about the extent to which people are responsible for their own prejudices and how easy it is either to blame society or someone else for those. And Nikki stands in stark contrast to that. What makes her a sympathetic character is that she wants to protect the community that she lives in rather than blame it.
Yeah, I think Nikki realises that, like in any big city or any community, there's those that are good and there's those that are bad. And the fact is that the media will always look at the bad things that are happening and the bad people, and they become more important almost than the people that are just living their lives, struggling to get the kids to school, struggling to make ends meet, struggling to hold down a job and look after their families and things. And I think what Nikki does is she shows that it's just a few bad people, if you like, that have succumbed to the criminal lifestyle, and that everybody else there is trying their best just to get on with it and live their life. But they're under threat from these few people that hold them to ransom by making the area that they live in unsafe.
Like all the best crime fighters, Nikki is quite prepared to take the gloves off. You come up with a very clever way of actually getting her away from police scrutiny. And I'm not going to give any spoilers, but I got the impression that you actually thoroughly enjoyed setting her free and setting a few wrongs right.
I did enjoy setting Nikki free because Gus, my previous character, who I loved writing him, but he pretty much stuck to the rules. With Nikki, I made her a detective sergeant because I thought if I give her a bit less responsibility, I can have her doing things that perhaps a detective inspector wouldn't do, and probably most detective sergeants wouldn't do either. But I think her boss realises that she's a bit of a renegade. He can't clip her wings too much. So he gives her a little bit of freedom to allow her to bring her own brand of justice. Now, she doesn't do anything completely illegal or anything. At the end of the day, it's all about policing and justice and making sure that she protects the innocent. So from that point of view, yeah, Nikki is a bit of a wild card, but she's so passionate and I liked writing her. It's funny because I've just handed in the edits for book two and I've softened her up a little bit because I felt she needed her rough edges, her rough corners smoothed off a little bit. She's beginning to become more engaged and more trusting of her colleagues and the people that she loves. She's beginning to invest a bit more trust in their love. She's becoming more well-rounded.
And the new book is due for publication later in the year. Does it have a title yet?
It's called Broken Silence. Basically, it's about modern-day slavery. And that came about because I went to an event with Baroness Lola Young at Bradford Literature Festival, and she was talking about modern-day slavery, and it made me come back home and research the sort of things that were happening. And, you know, modern-day slavery is all around us. I don't know if you've heard any of the adverts that ask people to be alert to somebody coming along and offering the services of a friend to do some work in the garden or whatever, and being a bit overbearing. And, you know, there's a sort of helpline if you suspect there is some sort of modern-day slavery going on. And she highlighted all sorts of ways that these people bring people into the country and use them to do really, really horrible jobs and keep them in really bad conditions, and how it's right there in your face. If you look closely, you can see it. Or you could see it if you got the police to go along and investigate it, but it's there. It's not happening elsewhere. It's happening everywhere. And that really, when I read some of the stories, I was like, oh, I've got to write something about this. So I did. and it's become Broken Silence, which will be out in April.
And hopefully the audiobook will be narrated by Shaheen Khan again?
Oh, I hope so. I think she did a fabulous job. You wonder who's going to be the narrator when it comes out on Audible. And I remember the first time one of my Gus books came out on Audible, the publisher had said to me, oh, what do you want? I said, oh, well, somebody Scottish. And they came back with a snippet from this guy. And I listened to it. And then I got back to them and I said, oh, you know, I said, he's more Dr. Finlay. I was thinking more David Tennant. Because they're so much younger than me, I don't think they quite got the Dr. Finlay reference. But it was this really old-sounding voice. And I thought, no, it needed to be somebody a bit younger for Gus. But Shaheen does it brilliantly for Nikki. I love it. I think it was an inspired choice.
Are you a big fan of audiobooks yourself?
I tend to read last thing at night on my Kindle. I have mental health issues and my concentration is quite bad. I find that an audiobook, I can't listen to it and retain the information in the same way as I can when I'm reading something, because then I can go back and look at it again. But when I'm in the car, I do listen to audiobooks then.
And you've mentioned your Scottish heritage. I can hear it in your voice. Whereabouts in Scotland are you from?
I'm from a small village called West Calder, which is in between Edinburgh and Glasgow. I've actually lived in Bradford for longer than I lived in Scotland now. So what happened was I went to university in Stirling in Scotland, and then I moved to Bradford to do teacher training. And Bradford is just so rich with diversity. So I taught in Bradford for 20 odd years, inner city schools, and just loved it. So I met my husband, who's Indian, and we've stayed.
So that work experience in inner city schools must really have fed into a lot of the plots for the books that you've written.
Oh, definitely. I think everything you experience can feed in at some point. But yeah, definitely. I loved teaching inner city. And when I first started, the schools were quite diverse. There was a range of ethnicities in my class. And then gradually it became more monocultural. But although there were issues, I came across kids who'd been abused. I came across kids whose older siblings were burning them with cigarettes, or kids who were locked in the cellar, or kids who were used as drug mules and drug runners and all that. But that wasn't the norm. The norm was getting your kids to school, trying to get the best for them, trying to make sure that they had some sort of qualification, that they could read and write, that they could go on and do GCSEs and A-levels and get on with their lives. That was the basic thing, and that's what everybody wants for the kids. It's just some people sometimes veer a bit off the track. So yeah, there was a lot of inspiration for it. I think it showed me the heart of Bradford, because I think that's one of the things about Bradford. It's got a lot of heart. It reminds me of Scotland in so many ways, because I think Scottish people are very friendly, but I also think Yorkshire people are incredibly friendly as well. And I think that's one of the reasons it was so easy to stay in Bradford.
Obviously, Last Request has got the serial killer that we've mentioned in it. And I was wondering, is it difficult to stop the murders from becoming voyeuristic when you're writing about them?
Yes. It's quite funny, actually, that you mentioned that, because, as I say, I've just sent edits in for book two, and my editor got back to me and she said, oh, there's a couple of bits where could you maybe just cut out little bits? And I do think it's important to try to, not to pull your punches, but also to not be voyeuristic about it. And it's a very difficult and thin line to tread, really, because you don't want people reading it for voyeuristic means. It's just, I find that if you leave it open-ended and don't go into huge details about what's been done, the reader tends to be able to imagine it themselves, because they live in the real world and they see the news clearly. There are bits in my books that are quite dark, and it does show a sub-life, if you like, of people who live by different codes. So I have to lead the reader along a path and then leave them to walk the rest of the way on their own. That's what I try to do. I hope I do anyway.
It's a very pacey book as well. You don't dwell on the gore.
No, I know what's going on in my mind, what I imagine is happening. So it's still with me, and it can be quite disturbing. So often when I write a scene that is quite hard or quite dark, I tend to then go for one of the more light-hearted ones. I think that's why I give Nikki and her partner Sajid that camaraderie, if you like, that light-hearted banter, is to alleviate some of the darkness, because if I didn't do that, it would drive me mad. Nobody wants to read something that's all dark and no light. You need a balance.
And presumably during your teaching career, you must have come across many children with visual impairments as well.
Actually, not very many. We tended to have more hearing impaired children.
Do you have any links to sight loss yourself?
My niece, Jaina, she was 17. She was just about to set her A-levels when she became very, very poorly with something called Stephen-Johnson syndrome, which is an extreme and very, very dangerous allergic reaction to medications. And she was very, very poorly. And as a result of that, she lost her sight and she lost some lung capacity as well. But she's absolutely inspiring, because she then went on. Obviously, she had to change the options that she was going to take, and she couldn't pursue art in the same way anymore. So she got a degree in holistic remedies, reflexology, things like that. And she's become a personal trainer, focusing on people who are visually impaired.
I know that you are a big supporter of the RNIB Library. Clearly, it's something that's very close to your heart and to your family. Liz Mistry, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and I hope you'll come back onto the show when the next book gets published.
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks very much for having me.
You all right in there? Nikki's sister Anika called from the kitchen. Nikki glowered at Hakeeb. You'd better start spilling before your mum comes through. For God's sakes, mum! Charlie, her face perfectly made up, eyeliner on point and her school skirt too damn short, flounced forward and flung herself onto the sofa beside Hakeeb, sliding her school bag round till it rested on her lap. If you'd give me half a chance to explain, Hakeeb didn't sell me it. Nikki glared at the lad, eyebrows raised. You gave them to her? You gave your 14-year-old cousin, E? That's no better. In fact, that's bloody worse. He ran the back of his hand across his nose and glanced at Charlie. I didn't. I wouldn't. She... He glanced at Charlie and shrugged. Charlie elbowed him in the ribs. Tell her then. You might as well. Head bowed, looking like a 2-year-old in trouble for stealing the Easter eggs, he mumbled something. What? Nikki's voice was sharp. She'd thought Hakeeb knew better than to bring drugs of any sort near her family, near her home, or even onto the damn estate. The hell had he been thinking? Clearing his throat, Hakeeb tried again. She, he jerked his thumb towards Charlie, confiscated it. You what? Nikki looked at her eldest daughter, who was all sulky indignation and... I told you so. What? So you thought I'd buy E's? I'm not a loser, you know. Nikki grinned and scooped the bags up. Charlie wasn't a loser. Definitely not. Nearing the sofa, she leaned over and kissed the top of her daughter's top-knot head. No, you're not. She leaned over further and cuffed Hakeeb's head. You, on the other hand, will be, if you don't stop with the damn drugs. Now I've got to bail you out yet again. Not good enough, Hakeeb. Not good enough.
Shaheen Khan narrating Last Request by Liz Mistry, which is TB704870. And Liz will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway in the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later, she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they had been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the Talking Books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, narrator Caroline Lennon brings an Irish brogue to the show, and Liz Mistry shares the books of her life. But before that, here at Read On, we love to learn about the books that you're reading, whether they're new titles or old favourites. You can let us know by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk, which is exactly what author and longtime friend of the show, N.B. Dixon, did after hearing our feature with Natalie Haynes. Here's her review of Natalie's latest novel, A Thousand Ships.
A deafening crack awoke her and she caught her breath. She looked around for the baby before remembering that he was no longer a baby, but had seen five summers come and go while the war raged outside the city walls. He was in his own room, of course he was. Her breathing slowed, and she waited to hear him cry out for his mother, terrified by the thunderstorm. But the cry did not come. He was brave, her little boy. Too brave to cry out as a lightning bolt, even if it was hurled by Zeus himself. She wrapped the coverlet over her shoulders and tried to guess what hour of the night it was. The pitter-patter of rain was growing louder. It must be early morning because she could see across the room. But the light was peculiar, a fat yellow colour which caught the dark red walls and painted them an ugly, bloody shade. How could the light be so yellow unless the sun was rising? And how could the sun fill her rooms when she could hear the rain falling on the roof? Disorientated by her recent dreams, it was several moments before she realised the acrid tang was in her nostrils, not her imagination. The crash had not been thunder, but a more earthly destruction. The pitter-patter was not rain, but the sound of dried wood and straw crackling in the heat. And the flickering yellow light was not the sun.
Hello, this is N.B. Dixon, and here is my review of A Thousand Ships by Natalie Haynes. It's actually quite interesting. I had to smile when I heard the interview with the author on Read On, as I've literally just finished reading the book. So, to the story. It's to do with the Trojan War, but it's from the point of view of all the women involved. Not the first story to have been written from the perspective of female characters, but I think one of the most compelling, and I think a lot of that has to do with the style. It's quite powerful because it's quite choppy. Some of the characters actually have very, very brief page time. They're literally in the story and out again. And I've heard some people criticise that, but I actually think it's quite realistic because, let's face it, a lot of people in war will literally, one moment they will be alive and in the next minute something will happen and they will be gone. Unfortunately, it's the way things go. So I think this book captures that really well.
Realising the danger she was in, she leapt from her bed, trying to undo her previous slowness. She must get outside and away from the fire. The smoke was already coating her tongue with its greasy soot. She called for her husband, Aeneas, and her son, Eurylion, but they made no reply. She left her small bedroom, the slender cot with its red-brown coverlet that she had so proudly woven for herself when she was first married, but she did not get far. She caught sight of the flames through the small high window just outside her bedroom door, and all speed slid away from her feet into the floor. It was not her home which was ablaze. It was the citadel, the highest point of the city of Troy, which only watchfires or sacrificial flames or Helios, god of the sun travelling overhead with his horse-drawn chariot, had ever lit before. Now fire was jumping through the columns of stone, so cool to the touch, and she watched in silence as part of the roof caught and a sudden shower of sparks flew from the wood, tiny whirling fireflies in the smoke.
I've always loved stories about Greek mythology. Between that, Robin Hood and King Arthur, they were kind of my favourite legends. And what they all have in common, in fact, is that they all end tragically. They don't have a lot of hope in any of them. But I do think tragic stories tend to stay with you more than ones with happy endings do. And A Thousand Ships, again, it really captures the brutality, the tragedy of the whole Trojan War. Whereas other stories you read sometimes try and eject a note of hope into the story. This really does tell it like it is.
Aeneas must have gone to help battle the flames, she thought. He would have run to offer assistance to his brothers, his cousins, carrying water and sand and anything they could find. It was not the first fire which had threatened the city since the siege began. And the men would do anything, everything, to save the citadel, site of Troy's most prized possessions, the treasury, the temples, the home of Priam, their king. The fear which had driven her from her bed ebbed as she saw her own house was not ablaze. She and her son were not in danger, but, as so often during this endless war, her husband was. The sharp fear for survival was replaced instantly with a familiar, pinching anxiety. She was so used to seeing him go out to fight the pestilence of Greeks who had been encamped outside the city for 10 long years, so used to the dread of watching him leave and the crippling fear of waiting for him to return, that now it settled on her almost comfortingly, like a dark bird perching on her shoulder. He had always come home before, she reminded herself. Always.
There's perhaps a faint suggestion at the end that all might not be too bleak, but really, if you are after a barrel of laughs, it's maybe not the best story to read, but I do think it's very powerful, very compelling, and well worth reading. Even if you're not familiar with the story of Troy, it's a great introduction, saves you having to read the Iliad, because it summarises it in a very modern way that's easy to understand, and it pretty much covers all the events leading up to, during and following the war. So it's well worth the read if you have any interest in Greek mythology, or if you just like a good historical novel, it's also worth picking up for that reason.
She stood in the doorway, unsure what to do. She should stay in the house, of course, or her husband might not be able to find her when he returned. Many years ago, he had promised that if the city ever fell, he would take her and their son and his father and any other Trojan survivors and sail away to found a new city. She had put her fingers on his lips to stop the words from coming out. Even saying such things could invite a mischievous god to make them come to pass. His beard tickled her hands, but she did not laugh. And nor did he. It's my duty, he had said. Priam commands me. Someone must take on the mantle of founding a new Troy if the worst should happen. She again tried to crush the flurry of thoughts that he would not return, that he was already dead, that the city would be razed before dawn, and that her home, like so many others, would not be here for anyone to return to.
Thanks to N.B. Dixon. And I'm delighted to say that, after appearing on the show, Natalie kindly arranged with her publisher to donate 1,000 ships to the RNIB Library for a nominal fee. So a huge thanks to Natalie and to Pan Macmillan for their great generosity. Is there a book that you'd like to tell us about? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk. Now, before we return to hear the books of Liz Mystery's life, The list of talking books narrated by Caroline Lennon reads like a roll call of the best in contemporary Irish fiction. Sebastian Barry, Maeve Binchy, Roddy Doyle and Anne Enright are all there amongst many others. She's a busy woman, but not too busy to drop into the Connect studio and tell me about her life as a narrator and of her love of books. Caroline Lennon, welcome to Read On.
Oh, hello. I feel very glad to be here.
So, how did you come to be a narrator for RNIB Talking Books?
Well, the whole thing started, I used to be on a radio show called The Archers. And
I know, they killed you off, didn't they?
No. First of all, they sent me to Germany, the ultimate punishment. And when that wasn't enough, I died for good. But while I was doing that, I got rung up by a producer of audiobooks and said, oh, would you like to try out doing this? Because it's not for everybody, you know. And I thought, oh, yes, I love books, love words. But yeah, I'll give it a go. And the first book that I did was enormously long. And I did think, ooh, what have I taken on? And it was a real learning experience. And then I've done quite a few at this stage, and I just got heard. And they said, ooh, do you want to come and record at the RNIB? And I said, why not? I do it everywhere else. So why not do it here? Lovely.
And can you remember what the first book you recorded was?
The first book that I ever recorded?
Yeah.
Yes, I can. I'm trying to think of... Yes, I think it was Isabel's Wedding by an Irish, very successful Irish writer called Sheila O'Flanagan. And I remember that at one point the character goes to Spain and there was a lot of Spanish pronunciations of food. I'm a big fan of food. And I did a lot of my card Spanish accent, which I found incredible. Intensely amusing. I'm not sure the producer thought it was as amusing as I did. But anyway, so that was my first one. And it was very long. So it was a real sort of baptism of fire. And, you know, you just have to build up the muscles for recording over a lot of material with lots of changes in it over a number of days. It's a very interesting process.
And you guys don't do massive amounts of retakes. I mean, a lot of it is first take recording, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's the time factor. So it's I always think of it as kind of old school acting. You know, like I've older chums of mine who were lucky enough to do things like Weekly Rep, where they'd be doing a major play in the evening, maybe a Shakespeare or a Shaw, and rehearsing something else in the day. So you, again, it's like another kind of muscle. You learn to make quick decisions and make them work. And sometimes, of course, they don't. And you think, oh, why did I go with that voice for that character? But you have to live with it. So it's very much at the cliff face of acting work, you know, and you can't be precious. I think most people who do this kind of work would be what you call good natural sight readers, which I think is a sort really a technical thing where, whether you realise it or not, your eye has flicked along at super high speed to the end of the line rather than sitting slowly on each word. So in fact, you're reading off a memory of the whole line, I think. That's my understanding. I've noticed it in myself. So in a way, as I'm saying the word, I'm seeing it for a second time.
And as you said, you were Siobhan Hathaway in The Archers for many years.
The Irish slapper.
Did you know you were going to be killed off?
Oh, yes, they did tell me. In fact, I was very lucky, really, because I originally when I joined the show, I don't think there was the intention for it to become such a big character. And it just that the character and the storyline just landed, and they came to me and said, oh, look, we're going to do some more with this. And I went, oh, yeah, fantastic, because it's a really enjoyable process. You'll hear actors say this a lot, and I'm sure people think we're all being very twee, but radio is fantastically good fun to do. And so the story developed over a number of years, really. I mean, I wasn't speaking all the time. When I first turned up, I always say this, and it's true, I think I spent the first 2 years going in for half a dozen eggs in Betty's shop. So I did say to them, is she going to turn out to be a big meringue maker or something? Because they said, no, we've got something else in mind. So yes, I did know that that my end was coming. Yes, yes, indeed.
And how does that compare to being a Talking Books narrator? Is it as immediate? Do you only do it in one?
Oh, well, that's a very interesting question. I think the biggest difference is, of course, when you're a narrator, it's just you. So it's you and the microphone. And, of course, if you're doing a show like The Archers, you're with your fellow cast members. I mean, some scenes you might do on your own, but mostly you're having conversations and interacting with other actors who are right beside you. The similarity is, I guess, that the performance, anything that you're doing goes through the mic. So when I'm doing a book, the image that happens for me, that works for me, is I imagine that the microphone is the ear of somebody that I'm speaking to, or their face. When you're doing a radio play, it's the same thing. Actually, you're sending the performance through the microphone. So your companions are beside you and you will make some eye contact with them. But there's a weird sort of mental thing that has to happen where you're sending the performance, you know. If you were doing a telly or a film, it's through the camera. It happens through the camera. So when you're doing recorded work, it happens through the microphone.
And obviously with the Talking Book, you are the entire ensemble cast. You, I suppose you're a director as well as an actor at that point as well,
that's,
are you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very astute observation. I think that is it. And I think why actors... because it's not at all glamorous job, let me tell you. But why actors like doing it when we like doing it? It's because, again, it's that old school thing where it's a very pure form of acting, because all the different characters that you get to do, characters are characters because of what they do. And a lot of theatre or film and TV work, you're boringly typecast if you're lucky enough ever to work. But to do, you're employed to look a certain way because you look a certain way and because you sound a certain way, which I'm sure people notice when they turn on the TV and they see the same actors doing everything. They're employed to do that for that reason. Whereas when you get to do a book, you get to play them all. And it's if you bring the right attitude to it, it is fantastically good for your acting, because you are using every bit of yourself. And I think that's, once you get used to playing all the parts and deciding the tone of a scene and everything, it can be quite hard to go back to being just a small cog in the machine.
I mentioned in the introduction that the list of books that you've narrated for the RNIB reads as a roll call of the best contemporary Irish writers. Clearly there's a reason you get given Irish books to narrate, as well as other books. But do you have a particular penchant for the Maeve Binchys and Roddy Doyles that you've been reading?
Well, I think the great thing about Irish literature is the love of the word, you know. We love the word in Ireland, and it doesn't mean we're any nicer than anybody else, but we do love a social interaction. Mm. And I think the best Irish writing captures that quality, and it's just such fun to get your mouth around these fantastically witty expressions. You know, Maeve Binchy is so totally different, of course, to Roddy Doyle, but what they share is, I think, a genuine love of people. And if you have that love and you love listening and observing people, that can come out in your writing. And people often talk about there's a warmth in Irish writing, and I think that's what they mean, even when you're dealing with some very dark and or strange subjects. I'm thinking of the last book that I recorded here. I think it was the last one I did, which is Annie Dunn, the Sebastian Barry, which has this sort of, and it's from my home place, Wicklow, so it resonated with me a great deal. And there's some unspoken darkness throughout that book. And yet the warmth between the characters is extraordinarily, incredibly moving, although almost nothing is ever said overtly. Nothing is said overtly. But underneath it all, there's something going on.
Oh, Kelsha is a distant place. Over the mountains from everywhere. You go over the mountains to get there. And eventually, through dreams. I can picture the two children in their coats arriving. It is the start of the summer, and all the customs of winter and spring are behind us. Not that those customs are tended to now much. My grand-nephew and grand-niece, titles that sound like the children of a Russian Tsar. My crab-apple tree seems to watch over their coming, like a poor man forever waiting for alms with cap in hand.
Annie Dunn by Sebastian Barry, narrated by my guest today, Caroline Lennon. We're talking about Irish stories, and there's a lot of Irish literature deals with the Irish diaspora around the world and homecomings and fractured families. Do you think that's something that's particular to Irish literature? The far-flung brothers, sisters, cousins all coming back to the homestead?
Yeah, well, it's certainly very specific to the Irish experience. I mean, all of my family have lived abroad for long periods. I mean, I've lived in England, and as has my sister, for a long time. My brother, I also lived in Japan. My brother lived in Japan. He's now living back home. So that experience of travel is the norm for Irish people. Most people will have a good number of their family who have gone abroad to live and sometimes never return. So it is a huge part of the Irish experience from, you know, about the 1840s, 50s, when the first great waves of emigration happened. It is part and parcel of our whole experience. So it would be odd not to cover it. It's that much of an extreme. We are wanderers. I think it's similar to the Jewish experience. You know that they. So it is a very it's very touchy, of course, because it's associated with a lot of loss. On the upside, of course, it means it's great to be outward looking and being fortunate enough to be allowed to go to other countries and make your living. So it contains everything within it, the best aspects of experience and some of the darker aspects, for sure.
Yes, and actually in books like Anne Enright's The Green Road, you have the tragedy and the laugh-out-loud humour.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I was lucky enough to record that. And I recognised so many of those characters. I just, you know, and my own mother was marvellous. But the difficult mother in that is not a stage. It's a real person. I mean, I guarantee you we've all met one of her. And I was sort of barking out loud. And she's particularly good. I have to say openly that I knew Anne Enright at Trinity, so I might be slightly more on her side anyway. But she's wonderful at evoking the landscape too, which is another very important feature in Irish writing. The you know, most of us came from a rural background, even if we weren't working on the farms ourselves. So the land is still incredibly important to us, and I think so. A writer who can describe it as vividly as she can, as in Sebastian Barry too, it's incredibly moving to us, and I think conveys to people around the world. There's something eternal about that.
And you're not just limited to reading books by Irish authors. There's some great chick lit and young adult fiction in there as well, I've noticed.
Yes, I was very, very lucky. I mean, I started off by doing a lot of chick lit, so which is very very entertaining and on the lighter side. And then suddenly, somehow, possibly by mistake, I think I got offered a detective fiction to do. And I thought, oh, yes, I'll have a go at that, because I'm an inveterate television watcher, as my friends will attest. And so I thought, oh, God, fantastic. And so I started doing a lot of that. And that's been very very challenging, because of course there's endless different types of scenes that you have to learn to do and keep up the energy. And then somebody said to me, oh, do you fancy doing this? Some young adult. I thought, oh, I'll give that a go. And of course that's another thing entirely, because the energy, of course, for young adult fiction is so exhausting. So you leave a day and you think, oh, well, I need to lie down now. But it's lovely. And I love the thought that you know, some young people are getting to hear a book maybe that they wouldn't otherwise. And you know, it's great. It's all gravy, as they say. The variety is great, actually, because I think if you were only doing one type of fiction, I think that would be not very motivating. I think, because you'd sort of feel, oh, I know what's about to happen now. You'd always feel that. But I'm lucky.
You mentioned how important it is for books to be made accessible to those who might not be able physically to read them. Do you have any connection to sight loss yourself?
No, fortunately, I don't. But my grandmother was a great reader, and as people age, you could see her no longer being able to read became a loss to her. And I have another friend of mine, John Cormack, I think it has recorded for RNIB indeed. His mother went blind, and we've talked about this a lot, that it's a fantastic feeling ever to be able to just lighten the burden, I think. And because if you are a lover of books, you know what that means to people. And I think that, you know, what little bit you can do, why not do it? I think it's fantastic.
I certainly, as a lover of books who's lost my sight, it was one of the cruelest things to lose. You lose the ability to step outside your physical situation if you can't read. And having somebody reading those stories to you is a huge comfort.
I think why it moves people so much is it sort of harks back to how we used to hear stories. You know, I think that in Ireland we call it the Shanachí, which is the old person who'd go around, and older person used to go around the different houses and tell the stories. And you know, you have it with Homer, so the travelling storyteller. So that telling of stories from one human being to another answers a very fundamental need, and it sort of predates the printed book, and so here I think you're getting the best of both worlds. You're getting the modern book, but you're getting that ancient human connection between, you know, human being to human being, the human voice sharing a story. And I like you, I feel very much the same way, that even if I'm reading a book, that the story is not mine, it's quite different. I mightn't even like the themes. But that opportunity to step outside of your own experience is something that's incredibly valuable to you, and I think a very necessary part of the human experience.
Well, Caroline Lennon, thank you so much for being our Shanachí, and I look forward to hearing your voice in my headphones for many years to come.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks to Caroline Lennon. Her reading of Annie Dunn by Sebastian Barry is TB21111. And you can find a full list of the books that she's narrated by searching the library website, rniblibrary.com, or calling the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and selecting option 5. Now it's back to Liz Mistry for the books of her life. Liz, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, I'd have to say there was a series of books, and it was The Famous Five. I remember when I was at primary school writing screeds and screeds and screeds when we're to write a story, and mine would have words like spiralling staircase and lighthouses and ramparts and lashings of cream and things like that in them, and they'd go on for pages. And it was because I'd read all these Famous Five books, and my teacher must have been like, oh no, here she goes again. Everybody else was struggling to write half a page, and I was like 12 pages on and still going. So I'd say that made me initially think, yeah, you know, this writing business is something that I'd like to do in the future. Although I didn't pick it up again properly until much, much later.
Everyone stared at Uncle Quentin. There he was, intently watching the jackdaws, his hands in his pockets. He hadn't seen the children or his wife. Timmy leapt to his feet and gambled over to George's father. He barked loudly. Uncle Quentin jumped and turned round. He saw Timmy, and then he saw all the others staring at him in real astonishment. Uncle Quentin did not look particularly pleased to see anyone.
He walked slowly over to them, a slight frown on his face. "This is a surprise," he said. "I had no idea you were all coming today." "Oh, Quentin," said his wife reproachfully. "I wrote it down for you in your diary. You know I did."
"Did you? Well, I haven't looked at my diary since, so it's no wonder I forgot," said Uncle Quentin, a little peevishly.
He kissed his wife, George and Anne, and shook hands with the boys. "Uncle Quentin, where did you come from?" asked Dick, who was eaten up with curiosity. "We've looked for you for ages."
"Oh, I was in my workroom," said Uncle Quentin vaguely.
"Well, but where's that?" demanded Dick. "Honestly, Uncle, we can't imagine where you hid yourself."
A huge selection of books by Enid Blyton is available from the RNIB Library in a full range of accessible formats, including this version of Five on Kieran Island Again, which is TB11876, narrated by Jan Francis. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, yes, there is, and it probably won't be one that you'd expect, but I would reread Silence of the Lambs on a Rainy Day, and that's by Thomas Harris. Perhaps some people might think, oh, Pride and Prejudice or Emma or Yes, I Love You or something like that. But for me, rainy days, cuddled up, coffee or hot chocolate, a nice fire blazing, to me, it's serial killer weather, if you like. So I would reread that. And also because Thomas Harris is just such a genius. The whole creation of Clarice Starling and Hannibal Lecter was just inspired. As an adult, that was one of the books that really made me think, yeah, as a writer and as a reader. So, yeah, I would reread that, definitely.
In the 10 seconds after her WPIK-TV mobile news unit slid to a stop, Jonetta Jones put in her earrings, powdered her beautiful brown face, and cased the situation. She and her news crew, monitoring the Baltimore County Police Radio, had arrived at Split City ahead of the patrol cars. All the news crews saw in their headlights was Clarice Starling standing in front of the garage door with her flashlight and her little laminated ID card, her hair plastered down by the drizzle. Jonetta Johnson could spot a rookie every time. She climbed out with the camera crew behind her and approached Starling. The bright lights came on. Mr. Yarr sank so far down in his Buick that only his hat was visible above the windowsill. "Jonetta Johnson, WPIK News, did you report a homicide?" Starling did not look very much like law, and she knew it. "I'm a federal officer, and this is a crime scene. I have to secure it until the Baltimore authorities..." The assistant cameraman had grabbed the bottom of the garage door and was trying to lift it. "Hold it," Starling said. "I'm talking to you, sir. Hold it. Back off, please. I'm not kidding with you. Help me out here." She wished hard for a badge, a uniform, anything. "Okay, Harry," the newswoman said. "Officer, we want to cooperate in every way. Frankly, this crew costs money, and I just want to know whether to even keep them here until the other authorities arrive. Will you tell me if there's a body in there? Cameras off, just between us. Tell me, and we'll wait. We'll be good, I promise. How about it?" "I'd wait if I were you," Starling said.
The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris is TB8469. It's narrated by Nigel Graham. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners?
I'm reading at the minute a book called A Gift for Dying, and it's by somebody called M.J. Arledge. Normally he writes books that are set in the UK, but this one is set in Chicago. And it's a police procedural, but with a difference. So there's this girl who has visions of people being killed, and she's been accurate. So it's that sort of uncanny cross-genre type of the book. And I love that. I love when crime fiction does something that it doesn't normally do. And I think more and more authors are exploring how crime fiction can also be a bit of a supernatural book or a bit of a romantic book as well. And they're really sort of pushing the barriers. But this book is just written beautifully. I don't know how it's going to end, but I love it. I find it difficult to put it down. Scott Migaret.
A dog barked on the street outside, snapping Adam out of it. Taking a final swig of his cold coffee, he seated himself at his desk and began the task of messaging his patients. For a few days, they had got either the answering machine or an out-of-office email, neither of which explained the reason for his sudden disappearance. Now he had to articulate it. But as most of his clients knew nothing of his private life, he was able to get away with saying that it had been a family emergency. He felt a fraud. It was much worse than that. But it saved him having to divulge more. Working his way through the list, he soon came to Cassie. He skipped over her, to contact a couple of clients further down the list, but soon returned to her name. What should he do? He'd said he'd help her, but then had vanished from her life. A part of him still wanted to help her, despite what she'd said to him last time, despite a lingering resentment that she had kept him from Faith during her awful ordeal. But did he have the emotional resilience right now? He felt guilty enough being away from Faith for half an hour. Torn, he ran his finger down the list, searching for another, less complicated case.
A Gift for Dying by M.J. Arledge is available in Braille from the RNIB Library and as a commercial audiobook, narrated by Ian Porter.
Liz Mystery, I shall leave you to get back to the book, and I look forward to welcoming you back in the future.
Oh, that'd be lovely. It's so nice to be here.
Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing us. The address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. We're also available as a podcast. Just search your provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week and the next chapter of Read On.